Imagine downloading one of those free-to-play games on your phone. You know the ones, right?
Oh, yeah, the ones with the giant free button in the App Store.
Exactly. So the button says free, you install it, and well, you're having a great time building a little city or whatever.
Right, for about an hour.
Yeah, exactly. An hour later, you hit this massive wall. Like, if you want to actually advance, you need to buy, gems.
Always the gems.
Always. So it's 50 cents to skip a timer, $2 for a new level. And by the end of the week, your quote-unquote free game has quietly drained like 80 bucks from your credit card.
It's the classic subscription trap, like applied perfectly to everyday life.
Yeah. You agree to the base price of zero, but you completely miss the architecture built underneath it that's designed to extract, I mean, much, much more.
You focus entirely on the sticker price. It happens all the time.
It does. And today, we are looking at how that exact same freemium trap operates on a massive scale in the real estate world.
Which is wild to think about.
It really is. We are jumping into this deep dive today on a really fascinating 2026 adjudicator's order. This is from Queensland's Office of the Commissioner for Body Corporate and Community Management.
And the case is Bayview Shores 2026.
Right. And our mission for this deep dive is to explore the seemingly mundane world of management contracts. Specifically, how the legal difference between a base fee and the actual costs can spark a massive dispute in a residential community.
Because if you live in an apartment or a condo or really any managed neighborhood, you already know the pain of monthly fees.
Oh, absolutely. But what happens when the people you hire to manage those fees are quietly operating on a freemium model? One that technically bypasses consumer protection laws.
To understand how a community gets caught in that snare, we have to look at how these decisions are actually made on the ground.
Yeah, let's set the scene for people.
Okay, so the entire legal battle at Bayview Shores started with a really standard routine community meeting. It generated pages of legal filings, but it started so simply.
Right, so Bayview Shores is a 101 lot community scheme. We're talking about a substantial residential complex here.
Big place, lots of residents.
Yeah, and it's managed by a body corporate, which is essentially, the volunteer committee of owners who make the day-to-day decisions.
Right, the folks who actually live there and step up to help.
Exactly. So on April 30th, 2026, they hold their annual general meeting, or AGM. And sitting on the agenda is Motion 12.
Just another item on the list.
Just another item. The proposal is to hire a company named Capital Strata Management to run the property for the next 2 years.
And if you're a resident looking at this agenda, I mean, the proposed fee looks incredibly reasonable.
It really does. It is listed as a base fee of $110 plus their local sales tax per lot per year.
So doing the math on that for a one-on-one lot community, the base management fee comes out to roughly $12,221 a year.
Which, over the 2 year term of the proposed contract, the total guaranteed price tag is about $24,442.
Which honestly feels like a steal for managing over 100 units.
Yeah, I'd probably vote yes, check the box, and just move on to the next item about like pool maintenance or whatever.
You're right, you wouldn't overthink it. But there is a very specific set of property laws in Queensland known as the Standard Module.
Ah, right.
And this module throws a massive wrench into this seemingly simple vote.
Because the standard module is essentially the legal rule book for how these communities are allowed to operate, right?
Exactly, particularly when it comes to spending the owner's money.
And there's a specific section we need to talk about, section 173.
Yes. Section 173 of this module outlines strict rules regarding what they call the relevant limit for major spending.
It's a financial ceiling, basically.
Yeah, a spending cap. For Bayview Shores, based on their size, that legally mandated limit is set at $30,300.
And the rule attached to that ceiling is all about anti-monopoly and competitive pricing, right? Like making sure they aren't just handing out favors.
Precisely. If a proposed contract is going to cost the community more than $30,300, the committee is legally forbidden from just handing the job to one company.
They can't just pick their buddy's company.
No, they are required to get at least two independent quotes.
Okay, so the underlying philosophy here is transparency.
Right. If you are going to commit a large sum of the community's funds, you have to prove you shopped around and found competitive options.
Which makes total sense.
Yeah.
But conversely, if the proposal is under that $30,300 limit.
Then the committee is allowed to proceed with just one quote.
Okay, which brings us back to Capital Strata Management and Motion 12.
Right, let's look at the numbers again.
The proposed contract, based on that $110 fee, was calculated at $24,442.
Comfortably below the $30,300 legal limit.
Very comfortably. So following the letter of the law, the committee didn't bother getting a second quote.
Why would they? They were under the cap.
Right. They presented capital as the sole option, the owners voted, and the contract was signed. Done deal.
On paper, the committee executed an open and shut case of legal compliance. They checked the spending limit, saw they were under it, and moved forward.
But, I mean, I'm looking at the source material here, and a couple named the Mulhollands.
Who own Lot 4 in this complex, yeah.
Right. The owners of Lot 4, they clearly didn't see it that way. Because they took this entire process to a legal adjudicator.
They definitely pushed back.
But if the base fee is mathematically under the legal limit, like, what is their argument for dragging the committee into a whole legal dispute?
Well, the Mulhollands' argument relies entirely on rejecting that cover page math.
Rejecting the 24,000 number.
Yeah. They are urging the adjudicator to look at the community's own historical financial receipts.
Yeah.
Because the reality of property management is that the base fee rarely, if ever, covers the actual work required to run a building.
Oh, that's where the freemium model kicks in.
Exactly. You pay the base fee just to have them on retainer, basically. But everything they actually do costs extra.
So like buying gems in the app.
Exactly like buying gems. The contract with Capital explicitly outlines a whole schedule of what are called additional services charged at an hourly rate.
What kind of services are we talking about?
We are talking about fees for attending extra committee meetings, dealing with unexpected maintenance crises, or preparing specific documents.
Oh, wow. So every little thing is an extra charge.
Yes. And on top of that, you have disbursements.
Which are what?
Out-of-pocket expenses passed directly to the community. Things like bulk postage, software subscription fees, massive amounts of photocopying.
Photocopying? Really?
Oh, yeah. It adds up fast.
Yeah.
And when you look at the real-world numbers from Bayview Shores, the ratio between the base fee and the actual cost is just staggering.
Okay, let's hear the numbers.
So the adjudicator's report pulls the community's financials from the previous year when Capital was also managing the property.
Right, so they have a track record.
A very clear track record. That previous year, the base management fee paid to Capital was around $10,600.
Okay.
But on top of that base fee, Capital charged the community almost $12,000 in those hourly additional services.
Wait, the hourly fees were higher than the base fee?
Higher than the base fee. And then they tacked on over $7,000 in disbursements.
Oh my God. So the extra charges completely dwarfed the base fee.
Entirely. And the Mulhollands pointed out that this wasn't just, you know, some bizarre anomaly from the past.
They didn't just have a really bad year for maintenance.
No, because looking forward, the community's own official budget for the upcoming year actually planned for these exact same massive extras.
You're kidding.
I'm not. The budget projected $15,000 in additional services and $700 in disbursements.
Okay, so adding all of those projections to the base fee, the true anticipated cost of hiring Capital for 2 years wasn't $24,000 at all.
Not even close.
The Mulholland showed it was expected to be, what, well over $66,000?
Yes, which completely shatters that $30,300 limit for major spending.
Oh, wow. So this creates a really profound legal tension, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Regarding how we interpret consumer protection laws.
It's a huge gray area. Do you calculate a legal spending limit based strictly on the fixed ink on the contract?
The guaranteed base fee, right?
Yeah. Or do you calculate it based on the practical reality of what everyone involved absolutely knows they're going to pay?
Right. The Mulhollands are basically saying, look, you can't pretend a $66,000 contract is a $24,000 contract just by recategorizing the bulk of the money as hourly add-ons.
It completely defeats the purpose of the two, quote, rule.
It makes the rule a joke.
Mm.
But I imagine the body corporate didn't just roll over on this.
Oh, no. The body corporate fought back fiercely against this logic. And they had a very specific, heavily weighted legal precedent in their corner.
Okay, I want to hear this because I can actually see the committee's perspective here, too.
How so?
Well, especially if we put ourselves in the shoes of a volunteer board member, right? How can anyone accurately predict the chaos of running a 101 lot building?
It's true. It's highly unpredictable.
Right. The whole reason management companies charge hourly for those extra services is because emergencies just happen.
You can't schedule a disaster.
Exactly. Say a massive storm hits and tears off a section of the roof. The manager might need to spend, I don't know, 50 extra hours coordinating with insurance adjusters and contractors.
And that's going to cost a lot of money in hourly fees.
Yeah, but you can't get a fixed quote in April for a storm that hasn't happened yet. So isn't it fundamentally unfair to punish a volunteer committee for not including unpredictable future emergencies in their upfront calculations?
Well, you've hit on the exact defense the body corporate used.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They argued that it is literally impossible to quantify the unquantifiable. And to support this, they cited a prominent district court decision known as Warren v. Body Corporate.
Okay, so they came armed with a judge's ruling that backs up that exact point. What were the specifics of the Warren case?
Well, in Warren, Judge McGill was dealing with this identical question of how to trigger major spending limits.
The same exact legal threshold.
The exact same one. And he made a very clear ruling that the quote-unquote cost of a proposal must operate prospectively.
Meaning, looking forward.
Yes. That means you evaluate the cost looking forward from the exact snapshot in time when the motion is proposed, based purely on what is definitively known right then.
Got it. So it's a snapshot, not a crystal ball.
Exactly. Judge McGill explicitly noted there is an error of unreality in expecting exact quotes for inherently unpredictable work.
Which makes sense.
He used plumbers and lawyers as his primary examples. I mean, a plumber cannot give you a reliable estimate to fix a leak until they literally smash through the drywall to see what's actually broken.
Right, they have to see the pipes first.
And a lawyer cannot tell you exactly how many hours a lawsuit will take because they have no idea how the opposing counsel will react.
It's all reactive.
So because of this inherent uncertainty, Judge McGill ruled that the spending limit rule has to be based on the anticipated fixed cost at the time, not the eventual actual bill.
Honestly, that makes perfect sense to me. It's like taking your car to a mechanic when the engine is making a weird noise.
Right.
You sign a work order approving like a $100 diagnostic fee.
Just to check it out.
Yeah. At that moment, you have only agreed to $100. But an hour later, the mechanic calls and says, your transmission is shredded and you need a $3,000 rebuild.
Which is always a terrible phone call to get.
The worst. But you can't retroactively claim your initial $100 diagnostic agreement was an illegal contract just because the final repair bill ended up being astronomical, you know?
Because the initial agreement was valid based on what you knew at the time.
Exactly.
And the body corporate leaned heavily on that exact analogy. They argued it would be legally absurd if a perfectly proper authorization,
and it was totally compliant on the day of the meeting,
right, suddenly morphed into an illegal act months later simply because unforeseeable events drove up the hourly bill.
They presented the $24,000 base fee as the fixed diagnostic cost.
And they categorized everything else as unpredictable transmission failures.
I mean, hearing that, the body corporate's defense sounds almost bulletproof to me. They've proposed a fixed base fee. The law says we don't punish people for lacking a crystal ball.
Hmm.
If I'm the adjudicator, I'm probably nodding along with the committee at this point.
It was a very strong defensive position, very persuasive.
I feel a but coming.
But adjudicator M. Suey, who was overseeing this Bayview Shores dispute, dug a little deeper into the specific facts of this community.
Okay, what did they find?
They found a fatal flaw in the committee's reliance on the Warren precedent, and the smoking gun was actually buried inside the committee's own paperwork.
Oh, man. Okay, let's look at the adjudicator's rebuttal. Where did the committee go wrong?
Well, adjudicator Siri pointed out a critical distinction between the unpredictable plumbers in the Warren case and capital strata management.
What's the difference?
In Bayview Shores, these extra hourly management fees were absolutely not unknown. The committee could not claim they were unforeseeable emergencies.
Oh, because they had that historical data from the previous year showing they always paid out massive hourly fees.
The historical data was part of it, yes. But the definitive proof was the upcoming budget itself.
Wait, what do you mean?
The committee literally wrote a line item allocating $15,000 specifically for additional management services into the budget they presented for the current year.
Oh, wow. So they can't stand in front of the adjudicator and say, we had no idea we would spend this money, because they literally printed a document saying, we plan to spend this money.
Precisely. They put it in writing. The adjudicator noted that while the down-to-the-penny final charges would only become known after the work was done,
sure, the exact final number,
the overarching costs themselves were absolutely anticipated. The committee fully expected to spend that money.
They budgeted for it.
Therefore, adjudicator Tsui ruled there was a very serious legal argument that these anticipated costs should have been lumped together with the base fee.
When calculating if the contract crossed the $30,300 threshold.
Exactly.
Okay, there's a wild catch-22 here.
Just...
Well, by being financially responsible, by doing good accounting and actually warning the community in the budget that extra costs were coming.
Right.
The committee accidentally manufactured the exact evidence the Mulholland's needed to prove they knew they would break the spending limit rule.
They handed them the evidence on a silver platter.
Yeah. If the committee had been sloppy and, like, failed to budget for it, they might have been able to plead ignorance under the Warren precedent.
It's totally possible.
But their own financial competence legally trapped them.
It really did. But it goes even deeper than that, venturing into the statutory duties of a volunteer committee.
What else did the adjudicator say?
Beyond just the strict mathematical limits of Section 173, the adjudicator highlighted that committees have a broader legal obligation to act reasonably.
Meaning they can't intentionally obscure the truth from the people voting.
Exactly. Think about the everyday lot owner at that annual general meeting. They sit down, they get a packet of papers, they look at Motion 12, and the only number explicitly attached to the capital contract is that $110 base fee per lot.
So the sticker price looks fantastic.
It looks great, but the committee knows, and their own budget proves they know, that the true cost of engaging capital will likely be triple that amount.
Right.
By isolating only the base fee on the voting motion, the notice presented to the owners was arguably deeply misleading.
Because you are denying the voters an informed choice.
You really are.
If you're voting on a multi-year vendor contract, you need the actual estimated hit to your wallet to compare it against other options. You can't make a democratic decision based on a fictional, artificially low sticker price.
And the adjudicator backed this up by referencing another district court case, which established that if a notice of a proposed resolution is misleading about its true effect or its financial implications, it can completely invalidate the resulting vote.
Wow. Even if they didn't mean to mislead anyone.
Yes. You cannot have a legally binding democratic decision if the electorate is voting on incomplete or deceptive information, regardless of whether the deception was intentional or just an administrative oversight.
Okay, so following the adjudicator's logic here, the committee likely broke the major spending rule by ignoring the anticipated hourly fees.
Yes.
They failed to get the legally required second quote.
Correct.
And the motion they used to pass the contract was misleading to the voters.
3-3.
That sounds like a total victory for the Mulholland's. I assume the adjudicator slammed the gavel, declared the contract void, and Capital Strata Management was just immediately fired.
Well, that is the logical assumption, for sure. But the legal system operates with a heavy dose of pragmatism.
What do you mean?
This brings in a crucial legal doctrine known as the balance of convenience.
Wait. If the adjudicator found they misled the voters and broke the threshold rules, why didn't they just tear the contract up right then? Is there some legal mechanism preventing that immediate action?
Well, the Mulholland's certainly tried to get it torn up. Alongside their main complaint, they filed for an interim order.
What's that?
An interim order is essentially an emergency injunction. They asked the adjudicator to immediately freeze the new management contract and stop the body corporate from implementing it while the final formal legal proceedings took place.
Ah, okay. Like hitting the pause button on reality while the lawyers argue.
Exactly. But the adjudicator completely dismissed the request for the interim order. The pause button was denied.
Even after agreeing the committee was probably in the wrong. That seems counterintuitive. Why let an illegally formed contract continue?
It comes down to the timeline and the potential for chaos.
Chaos.
Think about it. The annual general meeting where the vote occurred was on April 30.
Right.
The contract with Capital was officially signed and dated that exact same day. By the time the adjudicator is reviewing the Mulholland's application weeks later, the ink is dry.
So it's a done deal.
The contract is fully executed, and Capital Strata Management is actively running the building.
Oh, I see. They are already in the building, paying the bills, answering the phones, dealing with maintenance.
Which is where the balance of convenience test is applied. When a judge or adjudicator considers an interim order, they have to weigh two conflicting outcomes.
What causes more harm, basically?
Right. What causes more harm? Allowing a potentially flawed contract to continue temporarily, or forcing a massive, sudden disruption to correct it immediately.
I see.
Interim orders are powerful disruptive tools. They're usually reserved only for preventing irreparable harm, like, say, stopping someone from bulldozing a historic house.
Okay, I see the utilitarian logic here. It's like realizing the driver of your cross-country bus isn't legally certified, but you're already going 70 miles an hour down the interstate.
That's a great way to put it.
You don't yank the steering wheel out of their hands right in that moment, right? That would cause a catastrophic crash.
Everyone gets hurt in that scenario.
Yeah. You wait until the bus safely pulls into the next rest stop, and then you deal with the driver's paperwork.
That bus driver analogy perfectly captures the adjudicator's reasoning.
Oh, cool.
The adjudicator agreed with the body corporate that stopping the contract abruptly would cause immediate and severe disruption. You have a 101-lot community that suddenly has no one to pay the utility bills, organize urgent repairs, or handle resident emergencies.
Which would be a nightmare for the people living there.
And furthermore, because the contract was already legally signed, simply walking away from it could expose the entire community to a massive lawsuit from Capital for breach of contract damages.
Yikes. So the cure would be worse than the disease, at least in the short term.
Exactly. The adjudicator determined that while the Mulhollands have a remarkably strong case that will likely succeed at the final hearing, there is no imminent irreversible danger that justifies blowing up the administration of the building today.
So the final legal battle will play out eventually.
Yes. The Mulhollands' concerns can be fully addressed with final orders, but for now, Capital keeps managing the building.
So the bus keeps driving. But reading between the lines of the adjudicator's report, they left a pretty heavy hint for the committee, didn't they?
They absolutely did.
Yeah, because the adjudicator explicitly noted that the body corporate might want to proactively take steps to address the dispute themselves.
Right.
It sounded to me like a suggestion to convene an extraordinary general meeting, actually get a second quote, and run the vote again cleanly before the final legal hammer drops.
It was a very stern, polite way for the legal system to say, I am giving you a window of opportunity to clean up your own mess before I am forced to do it for you, potentially with severe financial penalties.
Right. So you might be wondering, why does a dispute over meeting minutes in a Queensland condo matter to you?
It matters a lot.
It really does.
Yeah.
Because if you are, say, reviewing a software vendor contract at your tech job, or maybe sitting on the board of a local nonprofit, the core lesson of Bayview Shores applies to almost any professional agreement you will ever evaluate.
You have to actively hunt for the freemium trap.
You have to. Transparency and complete financial foresight are just paramount.
The law and really basic financial common sense demands that we evaluate agreements based on their total foreseeable cost, not their artificially lowered base rate.
Right. Is historical data or your own internal budget proves that a vendor is inevitably going to charge you thousands of dollars in hourly extras and disbursements, you cannot ethically or legally pretend those costs don't exist when you are seeking approval for the spend.
If you are asking your community or your shareholders or your boss to approve a budget, giving them only the base fee is essentially a lie of omission.
You are denying them the ability to make a rational choice.
And looking at the broader implications of this case, I mean, it raises a really vital question about the industry itself.
Yeah.
We've spent this entire time analyzing whether the volunteer committee followed the rules, right?
Right.
But look at the sheer scale of the numbers involved. When a professional management company relies so heavily on additional hourly fees that those extra charges consistently dwarf the base fee by a factor of 2 or 3.
Which we saw here.
Doesn't that suggest the base fee model itself is fundamentally broken?
You know, or perhaps it's not broken at all. Perhaps it is functioning exactly as it was designed to.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what if this isn't just an accident of unpredictable plumbing issues or sudden legal disputes?
Okay.
What if the entire industry's standard pricing structure, you know, keeping base fees artificially low specifically to sneak under these exact types of major spending limits while making all the actual profit on unregulated hourly add-ons is a deliberate strategy.
Wow. That reframes the whole situation.
Right. The freemium model isn't a glitch. It's the core business strategy. You price the entry ticket so low that no one questions the lack of a second quote, knowing full well you'll make all your real money on the back-end fees.
It's incredibly cynical, but it makes so much sense.
If that's the reality of the market, maybe it's not the volunteer committees who are primarily at fault here. They're just regular people trying to read complex contracts.
Yeah. The real issue is the way these agreements are structured from the top down to bypass consumer protection laws. It certainly makes you evaluate who is really benefiting from the complexity of these contracts. Is it the owners or the vendors writing the terms?
That is a phenomenal point to leave things on. Thank you all for joining us on this deep dive into the hidden mechanics of management contracts.
That's been fascinating.
So the next time you get an envelope in the mail asking you to vote on a new community budget or you're asked to sign off on a new service at work. Remember the Mulhollands and Bayview Shores.
Look past the sticker price.
Yes. Search for the hourly rates, audit the historical disbursements, and always ask to see the true cost.
Never stop reading the fine print.
Until next time, don't let the freemium trap sink your budget.